Reverend Miller knew where to go and find Dudus Coke when the security forces did not. Can you imagine that? They for a month, over at least 70 people murdered or killed in this state of emergency declared in Kingston and other areas of Jamaica to apprehend Christopher Coke, and he eluded the security forces. But Reverend Miller knew where to go and find him. But I think we're going to talk about that later. Thank you very much for tuning in, for listening, and stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. And a reminder that you have been listening to Labrish. My name is Habte Selassie. We'll be back next week with another edition of the program. Labrish is produced by Ian Forrest, and who is assisted by Seduzo Kaim Billy. And Labrish is a De Jazz Mac production. Remember to tell the people whom you love that you love them, and show affection. With love, we'll find unity and strength. One love, walk good. She, chin, chin, go. Mr. Tosh. On one foundation. Got to build our love on one foundation. Got to build our love on one foundation. There will never be, yeah, no love at all. There will never be no love at all. I've got to put aside name segregation. Got to put aside theme organization. Got to put aside them denomination. There will never be no love at all. I mean, there will never be no love at all. So build our love on one foundation. Come, let us build our love on one solid foundation. Got to build our love. Oh, there will never be a single drop of blood. You won't have no freedom, yeah. Got to come together. We are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. Or there will never be, Lord of mercy, no love at all. There will never be, yeah, yeah, no love at all. We also got to realize we are one people, yeah. Got to realize that we are one. There will never
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, thrillingly, on recording, Mary Robinette Cowell, who I spoke with just yesterday afternoon. This is a good one. Stay tuned. The mix I'm playing repeats a little of the music. That's all right. Thank you. the music of Peter Schickele, extended and slightly confused version, because there's all kinds of problems so far this morning, and they all have to do with the word compliance, and they involve two things. One, this blessed copyright confessor thing where we have to actually log in this reprehensible software, what it is that we are doing on the air to comply with various copyright needs so that we can continue to get our musics paid for to an extent for internet streaming. Is that about right?
Oh, that's about right.
Yeah, that's about it.
No, it's pay the artists. It has nothing to do, we get nothing for it except that.
No, we don't get anything. Well, but it's so that if CPB, in theory, can pay a fund, that in turn theoretically pays the artist, right?
Something like that.
Yeah, okay. And that's part one. Part two, and it's not like we don't have a very full show this morning, part two is all about the democratic process here in the board of WBAI. Yes, not you know, well, why didn't they do this, by the way, during fundraising? That would have been fun.
Well, because we can't interrupt fundraising to do
radio. Yeah.
Things that are required.
So we have to cover these issues involving the upcoming elections, and I have a cart that oh please, who produced this?
Stu and Skeptic Stu and who's the other guy?
Idealist Gary. Are these real people?
Oh, more real than you can imagine.
Okay, I haven't been around during the days, and this may be part of why. Well, this is what. So let's actually. Should I start, do you think, with this? I should start with this,
yeah,
I think.
You could.
And that, which says basically that nominations are open for WBAI. Oh, once again, this is poorly written copy, right? No grammar whatsoever. I'm gonna redline a lot of this. Nominations are open for WBAI 2010. Local Station Board Election. Grammar bad, this is written for radio, not. Let me rephrase.
Now read the hyperlink. Just click on Jim's voice.
Yes, let me rephrase that. Nominations are open for people running for WBAI's 20 a local station board election for 2010. Should be something like that. Please visit PacificaElections2010.org, you all remember that, right, to request a nomination package. Contact Nicole Justice-Hilton, that's H-Y-L-T-O-N, your local elections supervisor, all caps, via LES_WBAI@Pacifica.org or at 347-329-4533. Remember to renew your membership by donating $25, and they put the dollar sign after the number, $25 before June 30th in order to participate as a candidate or voter. Candidate nomination packages must be received before June 30th. In other words, if you as a listener would like to join the WBAI local board in the democratic process, you need to get a nomination package. You need to fill this out. You need to get a certain number of signatures, which is not difficult to do, and stuff like that. And you need to be a member of WBAI. If you are not already a member, which, you know, this doesn't mention that, then you have time to become a member for the $25 rate, and then you can be a candidate for the local board, okay? Then part two of this is, we need your feedback in order to make Pacifica Elections a sustainable mechanism for you to get involved in WBAI. What does that mean? This is me talking now. A sustainable mechanism for you to get involved in WBAI. I guess it's new. Sustainable, you know, is, you know, a word involving organics. You, Please check out the Green Election Survey by visiting Green Election Link online at PacificaElections2010.org. Wow. Okay. So let me do that sentence again. Please check out the Green Election Survey by visiting Green Election Link online at PacificaElections2010.org. Thank you, Smiley. And this is signed Nicole Justice Hilton, LES, and LES is not Les. It's, you know, it's not like Les Brown and his band of renown or something. This is local election supervisor. Well, I want to be the grammarian for these people. I'm really, really willing to help just I won't change the content. I just want to make this readable for radio. That's all. I'm quite willing. Anybody hears me? Anybody involved? I suppose I should be writing the LES myself and saying I'm quite happy to volunteer to simply do, you know, a copy edit intended for radio, and I will send it back to you folk. And then, you know, so that you're sure that I am not changing the intent in any way, shape, or form. Just trying to make it, you know, easier for us. Okay, and now I have a recorded thing about that. We have to give this a certain amount of time. The materials for this are extremely limited. So we takes what we got, and in this case, this is what Max Schmid was able to give me. I'm going to play this, and then we're going to start the show proper. Except, let's see, I'm not even sure if I am playing this. Hey, Max, if you can hear me.
Sunana ne Hajiara Matu Ahmed, na gaiswa jama'a, ganinang Awanga Radio WBAI.
Okay, and that was not the cut that I had double-clicked on. Let's, okay, where is that now? There's a cart. They call these carts because they replace what used to be on the cart machine. It moved.
Yeah,
Roll of the LSB? Is that,
The Mandarin at station the bottom? ID?
Yeah, it's something like that. It was all the way, somehow this scrolled all the way to the top is what happened. Well, I wasn't looking. Okay, let's try this one. So it's double click there. That doesn't start it.
Sunanane
Hajiara
Matu Ahmed.
Well.
Jama'a.
Okay, that's what happens. You can see I've got this selected. I have the box clicked, right? There's a little check mark in it. Let's make sure there isn't one on the Mandarin. Okay, so here, I've got this clicked, right? Does it look like I've got the...
Yeah, but there's some clicked above it.
Huh?
There's some clicked up here.
Okay, oh, look at that. Yes. Let's unclick those. Chuck D. And... one from Rwanda, but that wasn't what was playing.
Are you sure? Do you
yes.
speak Rwandese?
I can hear the difference of language, and I saw that it was a different one. Okay, I'm not seeing anything else clicked now except the one of my choice, right? Let's try that again. Oh, it worked.
Hey, Gary. Politics, politrix, a waste of resources... That's what I think about the so-called local station board election. No matter what the truth, it always seems to get drowned out by never-ending drama. Battles for power. I want no part in it.
Stu, I feel you. In this world dominated by multinational corporations, it seems like trying to push forward a cause is impossible. But if you give up, you let the system win. WBAI local station board election is a unique fusion of media and democracy. And it's the only listener-supported network for which a mechanism for getting involved exists. You have an opportunity to run as a candidate and vote.
Yeah, but does the local station board have any teeth?
The local station board has the power to make or break WBAI. They make important decisions with respect to the budget, evaluating management, overseeing programming, and creating policy. It's essential that the candidates running bring their expertise to the table, be it in fundraising or technology or community outreach. There's a slew of local station board duties outlined in the Pacifica bylaws, which you can find on PacificaElections2010.org.
Well, I'll believe it when I see it. The impression I have of the local station board is a bunch of just wasting precious resources.
Well, all more reason to be proactive. Run or vote in this year's election to change the downward spiral. For all of you listening, please visit PacificaElections2010.org. Contact your local election supervisor, Nicole Justice Hilton, at LES_WBAI@Pacifica.org. And 347-329-4533.
Remember to renew your membership by donating $25 before June 30th in order to participate as a candidate or voter. Candidate nomination packages must be received before June 30th.
Well, alas, they didn't have too much to say that I hadn't already read you, but that's the official word. Okay, let us get to the business now of Hour of the Wolf for this morning, because we have a wonderful guest. She was not able to be here live because she had to fly back home to Portland, Oregon. This time last year, she was still living here, but she was in town auditioning for a show, and will be back reading at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series in August, and perhaps we can have some listener phone calls, and we had so much to talk about, which you are going to hear in a moment. But first, let's see. The next New York Review of Science Fiction readings. Yeah, I know the season is over. We started it again. Well, I'll tell you much more about this next week, but it's July 6th. Put aside the date. Tuesday, July 6th, 6:30 at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, 138 Sullivan Street. Saladin Ahmed, who has been on this program, is a wonderful writer, will read. And Paolo, and he was a nominee, a Nebula Award nominee this year for a short story. And the winner of the Nebula Award for Best Novel will be the other reader, Paolo Bacigalupi, who is one of the phenoms of the first part of the 21st century in science fiction writing. He is he's an amazing writer, and this will be his debut reading in New York. I am sure and hopeful that this will not be the last time. So take note, if you want more information, write me, Jim, at ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, or you can also write me here, WBAI, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 10005, Jim Freund, or just Hour of the Wolf, one of the two. Freund is F-R-E-U-N-D. And I'll give you more information. You can also look it up on Facebook or follow me on Twitter. It's Jim Freund on Twitter, and, yeah, well, pretty much the same on Facebook, okay? So, let me try. The computers here have been mucked with, not necessarily by Manglement or anybody, but, you know, there's a whole lot of people in here every week, and so it's a little harder for me to navigate through this to find. I pretty much do everything and on a computer, bringing it on a hard drive, and use that to play things. And this seems to be a good working model, but alas, the control room here is really not set up for that. And so, what can I tell you? So, give me but a moment, and so I can simply prepare. Here we go. Okay. Audio. Oh, good. I actually have it queued up now, and I'm going to do that and just stop and be ready to play. Good. Okay. Mary Robinette Kowal. is herself a phenom in writing. She has mostly been known for her short stories. She was nominated for a Hugo last year for Evil Robot Monkey, which she read on this program. Her stories have been in Asimov, Strange Horizon, often collected in many of the year's best anthologies. She is a puppeteer. She is a voice actor, meaning that she's one. Well, you'll hear. We're actually going to be talking in the first part of this interview, and then she'll read. But we're going to talk largely about her voice acting and stuff. So, and what we think of ebooks and people reading and stuff like that. So it's fascinating. Then you will hear. You will hear one of the best examples of voice reading in the latter part. So let's see. As a voice actor, she has performed for Lazytown on CBS, the Center for Puppetry Arts, Jim Henson Pictures, and she founded Other Hand Productions. Her designs have garnered 2 UNIMA/USA Citations of Excellence, the highest award an American puppeteer can achieve. And she records fiction for such authors as Cage Baker, Cory Doctorow, and John Scalzi, which is fascinating because each of these people are people who are very, very well aware of what audio can do. So that's a good basic introduction. Why don't I move out of the way for the moment and let the interview commence? So you don't have to set the Wayback Machine too far at all this time. Set it back for about, 2:30 yesterday afternoon, in an undisclosed location in Brooklyn. And, okay, one could say we were rolling if there was anything to roll in a digital recorder. And here I am, happily but thoroughly unprepared, because this is an interview that came about very last minute and sort of by kismet. But I am with Mary Robinette Cole, who was on the show, was it not long after
Evil Robot Monkey.
I knew it was a three-word version of
yes.
that.
It was not long after it was nominated. Mm-hmm. So that would have been, sometime last year.
Yeah.
And it was cold outside.
I'm thinking it was about 15 or 16 months ago.
Yeah.
This being, for those who are listening in the future on podcast or whatever,
yes.
This is June of 2010,
mm-hmm.
of the very skiffy year of 2010.
I love 2010.
Yeah, it's well, I was scared enough when 2001 came about.
Yes. Well, I mean, there are films about that.
Yes.
2010. When I sold the novel and people were asking me when it was coming out, I'm like, 2010? And everyone was like, oh, that's so far away. And I said, well, actually, no, that's next year.
Yeah, I know. I'm still constantly doing that. I'm looking at my calendar and seeing that, or I'm thinking, oh, well, such and such happened in the early 90s. That's like only 10 years ago, right? No, I'm thinking 10 years ago, because I can't accept how far into the 21st century.
Yes.
We're no longer even in the first decade of the new millennium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a nice place to be. I like living in the future.
Yeah, it's fun. I don't have the technologies that I thought I would have, but the ones I do have are pretty cool.
You know, the only ones that I'm really missing are the jetpack. I don't need the flying car, and frankly, I think they're probably a bad plan given the environmental issues we've got going on right now.
Yeah, well, if it didn't use gas.
If it didn't use gas, sure. You know, a vegetable oil burning flying car, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that I could totally get behind.
Just
that.
Something anti-gravity, maybe. Or...
Well, yeah, I mean, if we had anti-gravity, like, everything would change. I mean,
it would make it so much easier.
It wouldn't just be transportation, it would be the way buildings are erected.
Oh, absolutely. You could have a earth side view, the apartment facing down,
mm-hmm.
and
absolutely.
Mirrors would just reflect
yes. Yes.
The surface.
You know, moving of shipping would be easier too. Everything. We would no longer have to worry about trying to escape the gravity well. Getting people into space, once you have anti-gravity, that becomes very simple.
Yeah. I once actually did, this is many years ago, when I was still co-hosting with Margot Adler,
mm-hmm.
I did a show in which I asked people where they would live if gravity were not an issue. And I left the rest of the questions to their imagination.
Yeah.
And that the one I mentioned was mine, so that with the floor view projected through mirrors, that was always mine.
Yeah. That would be nice.
Yeah.
So many options.
Indeed. Now, people will by now know more about you because I will have read a proper introduction on the air before we got to this point. But what's the most exciting stuff in your life at this point? Is it the writing? There's a novel?
Well, there's my novel, Shades of Milk and Honey, comes out August 3rd, which is very exciting.
I didn't realize it was that imminent.
Yes.
Yeah, 2010, duh.
2010,
it's that far away.
I know.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. So most of my focus and attention is on that right now.
And that's coming out from?
That's coming out from Tor.
From
and
Tor.
Then
Shades
also,
of Milk and Honey by Mary Robinette Cole from Tor Books. I'd get that all.
Thank you.
That soundbite in there.
Thank you. There's one other soundbite, which is also the audiobook of Shades of Milk and Honey by Mary Robinette Cole, is coming out from Macmillan and read by the author.
Far out.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Because you know how few people, because you're in both businesses, you're a writer, you're a professional reader, an actress. So how many people actually get to read their own books? Nalo Hopkinson told me how she failed the audition for Midnight Robber.
Wow. Yeah. It is not something they do often, and they made that very clear. And I have actually
And they're probably afraid to admit it because they're afraid it'll start a trend.
Well, I mean, Escape Pod has a policy, or had, I don't know if they still do, had a policy that the author never read their own story.
Correct.
And it did not matter. You know, I have narrated for Escape Pod,
right.
But they will not let me narrate my own story. And it's just that blanket statement. And I think that's, you know, it certainly makes judgment calls easier.
Yeah. I'm sort of the other way. I'll live with a lesser reading, perhaps, by the author.
Yeah, but it's...
Because I like hearing their intent.
Well, yes, I like hearing their intent when you can hear their intent.
Depends on the author.
There have been authors who, I mean, I sat through a reading that went something like this. And then they ran down the street, gunshots,
firing. That was Ezra Pound, how lucky.
She screamed as the blood spattered. And you're just like, I think this is supposed to be dramatic, and you're killing it. Oh,
yeah.
God.
Yeah. Have you ever heard Ezra Pound's recordings?
No.
He reads like that.
Oh.
And on purpose,
well,
loud, and, you know, this is his concept of drama.
Oh, interesting.
As you said.
Yeah.
Yeah, he especially his poetry.
Yeah. Well, and it is, you know, my thing about reading and writing in general is that the written form was really created to capture the spoken word. So that when one is reading a story, one should remember that really what you're doing is you're telling a story. And like if you're telling a story to someone in person about something that happened, you know, your day, it's like, well, I was walking down the street and then this guy came out of nowhere and it was just like, and he had these hands that were huge and he was juggling fire. But then you write the same thing down on the page and you hand it to someone and all they're thinking about is the words on the page and the shapes that they make, and they're not thinking about the content so much. So you wind up with, and I was walking down the street, and a man came out, and he had these hands, and they were huge.
I know who reads
huge.
That. I have a friend who reads like that named Kindle.
Yes. And you lose, I think, some of the storytelling, because when a person is reading it to themselves, I think that frequently you do get the authorial voice, in ways that you don't get when the author is actually reading it, if they are only thinking about the words on the page and not the story that they're telling.
Yeah. Yeah, the policy on Hour of the Wolf, and for that, and the thing that I guess I've made a specialty of in now running the reading series that I do is the author's voice.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And yeah, you give up a lot.
Not always.
But as you say, not always, and sometimes it's that much more fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when the author, and it's not that I'm saying that everyone has to act, but there are unfortunately some authors who do kill their text, who don't have their own voice in their mouth, just, you know, nerves or what have you.
Yeah, especially live on the radio.
Especially live on the radio. But there are other times when, you know, you hear it and it's like, oh, this story makes so much more sense now. Or the one that I also love is, oh, so that's how you pronounce that.
Yes. That's a soft G. I wouldn't have guessed.
No, I had no idea.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is the interesting thing about doing narration for other people's works. Like I'm reading, and let me plug someone else, I'm reading Seanan McGuire's October Day series. And one of the characters in there was G-I-L-I. And I looked at it.
Could be Healy, could be Geely.
Could be Gilly, could be Jilly.
Yeah.
Sorry, it was G-I-L-L-I, I think.
Oh, okay.
I think there were two L's. And so, you know, I wrote to the author. Or actually, the director wrote to the author. I'm like, so is that Gilly, Jilly? And I had guessed wrong. And it's Jilly.
Okay.
But it's that kind of thing. It's like, you know, there are things that the author knows and intends, and you can only get that from the author.
Yeah. And also, I find the pace. Mm-hmm. If a person, if an author, if a writer is trying to make something really exciting, they will punch it very likely in different places than I might.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
But there's also a certain point where some of that is interpretive.
Yes.
And I actually had a discussion with one writer in which I said, no, I would do it like this, and that's how I'm going to do it. And because it was, I don't remember what the mm-hmm. issue was, but it was an interpretive point. And I said, this is how I read it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the reader, and do you have any problem with this? And they said no, and so okay.
Yeah, when I had this evil robot monkey on Escape Pod, it was actually really interesting because, of course, there's an audio version of me recording it too, and this is
the Hour of the Wolf version.
Yes, and they're nothing alike, which is interesting because it's still the same story.
That's interesting because those two were recorded performances, and mm-hmm. Hour of the Wolf was a live performance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although it wasn't a live audience.
Correct.
Performance. No, dynamic.
I actually meant the Escape Pod that's a different era.
Right, different reader.
Yeah, different reader. And it's really interesting to see how someone else interprets.
And that's where I get all snobbish and say, ha-ha! I got Mary reading it! Thank you.
There you go. But it is, it's really interesting.
Yes, I did get a professional actress.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah. So, but it's just something I'm fond of doing, is having that voice. And I know that it means the reading quality isn't quite the same. But you know what? Listeners seem to like that.
Yeah, I mean, it really... It gives you more of a connection with the author. One of the things we talked about with Shades of Milk and Honey when I was talking to Macmillan about it is whether or not I should do it in a British accent. Because it's a novel. It's, you know, it's supposed to be that the elevator pitch is Jane Austen with magic. And the casting director said that if she were not using me, because it's set in the south of England in 1814, she would totally have cast a British actress.
Mm-hmm.
And since I have a British accent in my repertoire, we sat there and talked about it for a little bit. It's like,
it's a tough call. Do you want to hear the author reading their work?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want to hear the actress performing
right.
the author's work? Because there is
a difference. And we finally decided to go with the British accent because I was like, you know, if I were wanting you to cast it, I would also want you to do it with a British accent. And it's still me reading it.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you get to do any introduction or anything so people can hear?
No. It's just we're treating it like a regular audiobook.
Okay.
And I have a dialect coach who sits in the room with me while we're recording. We're about halfway through the book right now before I had to head out of town to do some business, which is, brings me here.
You're recording this in Portland.
Yeah, recording it in Portland, which is very nice. So the October Day books I record for Brilliance Audio, and that's in Michigan. And that's actually nice, too, because, you know, there's no distractions. You go in, you're locked in the booth for 8 hours.
Yeah, they just announced a new line of audiobooks today.
Yeah, I can't remember what it is.
Yeah, neither can I, but they just launched something new.
Yes, and I knew about it because we were talking ahead of time, and I cannot remember the name of it, which is embarrassing.
Yeah.
But it's exciting.
Yeah, the idea, I'm taking a look at that and just being thrilled that the idea of the listening ear is coming more and more into prominence.
Yes.
To the point where I got, everybody on the radio can see this, and I got a carton.
Oh, look at your carton. The carton is a brown box.
Yes, it is. And what is in it are 50 copies of this that I'm supposed to give out to people.
Wow, ZBS Audio Adventures.
Yeah, the ZBS.
Steam Dreamers of Inverness.
Yes.
Oh. Well,
that's about their, oh, that's about their eighth or ninth.
Look at this.
Story
catalog.
Of...
I have something shiny that you can't see.
Yeah, it's lovely. Well, BAI listeners should know some of the... ZBS Productions, Ruby Intergalactic Gumshoe is always...
Oh, yeah, Ruby.
Yeah,
she's
that's
fantastic.
Them. That's them, and this is a sequel, the steampunk sequel, to the Fourth Tower of Inverness. But it
nice.
Is not just steampunk. This is steampunk parody of steampunk taken
Funny.
To the umpteenth. They also distribute other...
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, they've got Dinotopia.
I think they worked on Dinotopia,
yeah.
But I'm not sure. I think that's how they stayed in business for a while.
You gotta love that. And Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Hello.
Yes, which I premiered
Excellent.
On the radio on this continent. So I'm
did
very,
you?
I did. I'm very proud of it.
As
it
well you should be.
It was a pirated edition. And I can now tell people that the pirate was a gentleman by the name of Douglas Adams. So they can try... He went around to the Pacifica stations, and he gave us BBC transcription discs.
Oh, funny.
So
evil man.
Yes, he was. And we had it about 3 years before NPR did.
Oh, that's funny.
But then again, they were legal about it. He just wanted it on in the U.S.
You know, you can't fault him for that.
You know, this was just the author... I think the professional word for this is kvelling.
Yeah.
and he was delightful. I had him on the show 4 times
oh, wow.
through the years. And but yes, I get to boast.
Yes, you do.
Somebody else unknowledgeably thinks that another person who originally worked on Hour of the Wolf did it on the West Coast.
Uh-huh.
And that was the wonderful Mike Odell, who did... the other major science fiction show in the country, Hour 25. But he died in the 80s. I mean, it was young.
Mm.
It was awful.
Oh.
But so on his Wikipedia site, it says it was him. And the thing is, well, guess what? Douglas went to both two out of the...
Yeah.
Actually, he also did it in our San Francisco station.
Uh-huh.
He gave it to Richard Lupoff there.
Oh,
to Dick Lupoff. So we each got a copy, but I had it 2 weeks earlier.
Of
course, don't know that story out there. And I'm not going to go to war with people on Wikipedia.
Oh, no.
Over, you know, the earlier accomplishment of a highly talented and wonderful guy who's passed on.
Yeah.
But I say it here on the radio.
Absolutely. This can be used as a source.
I did it first. I was there a week earlier or something like that.
Back in my day.
Yes, in my day. But it's all radio drama. And it's all audio.
Yeah. Yeah. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was really the first radio show that I fell in love with.
Yeah.
And it was just, oh my, I had heard nothing like it before, and really nothing like it since.
It was unique.
Mm-hmm.
The later episodes, seasons or series 3, 4, and 5 of Hitchhikers, done by Dirk Miggs, I think his name is, they have the spirit, they have the actors, but it's not quite the same. It's, for one thing, it's way too British. I mean, the entire fourth series is all about cricket. It's all about cricket. Cricket playing sofas versus the divans. It's...
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The...
Douglas would have enjoyed it, no doubt.
No doubt. Yeah, the thing that I remember most was... that I loved was Marvin. And the elevator, down is nice.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's a wonderful... wonderful piece. For it was my first, and I'm a generation before you, is the Firesign Theater.
Yes.
Which came out of Pacifico Radio.
Yeah.
That's one of ours. And for me, that was the first. And being from the hippie days, we could alter consciousness and recite it. And I can still recite some of it frighteningly.
Nice.
And of course, one of them, one of the Firesign Theater... teaches the runs the Midwest Radio Drama Workshop.
Ah.
So that, nice. That comes out of the legacy of the Firesign Theater.
Nice.
And then there's ZBS, who I would say for me was the third, with Ruby Galactic Gumshoe or Intergalactic Gumshoe, whoever. It was all about the ads.
Yes.
The Android Sisters.
Yes.
Who were just wonderful.
Yeah.
They were so good, they put out their own album.
You gotta love that.
Oh, they were fabulous.
Yeah.
So
did you know I have an ogle?
I'm sorry?
Did you know I have a silver ogle?
No!
Yeah!
My God, I'm always learning things about you.
Yeah, I work with a radio theater company out in Portland called Willamette Radio Workshop, and they have a writing workshop in the summers, and then we'll sometimes produce things. And I wrote a piece for a show that they did called Murder of Crows, and got an ogle.
Oh my God, that's fabulous.
Yeah.
Is this available? Is the drama available?
Yeah, yeah. You can actually, I think it's, you can order it on the website, radiowork.com, but... and certainly by the time I get home, I'm sure that Sam will have it available for order. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was, there were three different pieces.
And where was this broadcast first?
This was first broadcast, I think, on KABU.
Uh-huh. One of the great, great non-commercial stations in this country.
Yeah.
Absolutely. For those New Yorkers who don't know, KABU is fabulous. And they were originally part of another group, as I recall, the Crab Nebula, K-R-A-B.
Oh.
And I think K-R-A-B, I think, was out of Seattle.
Oh, okay.
And they joined together a whole bunch of stations, but they... That the Crab Nebula, which is one of the best names,
come on.
Yeah,
it really is.
You know, it did not survive, or some of the key stations did not survive, but we have KABU still.
Yeah.
And there's KABU, there's the one in Minneapolis,
yeah.
There's KCRW, mm-hmm. there's GBH, and then there's the Pacific stations,
yeah.
And there's a couple more.
Yeah. Now, KABU is great, and they're very supportive, too. We were doing, basically, we had two forms, and still do, but we would do, because I've been away, that's why I keep talking about it in past tense. So when I was working with them, we would...
You say you've been away. Our point of view here
yes,
in
I've
New
been
York
here, yes.
Is
yeah.
is you went away, but...
Yeah, it's true. Well, you know, I mean, I was in Portland, and then I went to Iceland for a year and a half, and then
right.
I came to New York for 2 years, so, you know, I'm a little out of touch with Portland, even though we've been back for a while, but basically they would do live shows, so live in front of an audience, you know, Foley, everything live, and then we'd also do studio recordings as well, And my recollection is that the KABU broadcast was we had done for a live audience and then did a studio recording, and the studio recording was what was broadcast.
Ah, okay. Well, that follows.
Yeah. But then for we would also go in and do things live on the air.
Ah, okay.
Which, you know, which was being recorded. So we did a shadow recreation.
Oh, okay.
And then...
Was it one of the Alfred Bester scripts? He asked fanishly. Because Alfie was the... Well, he was the script editor of The Shadow for like 20 years
or something
absurd. I did
not know that.
Yeah, he wrote a lot of The Shadow, but he was the script editor, the overseer.
No, I didn't
of
know that.
Of The Shadow and some other shows at NBC for years. Excuse me, The Blue Network.
Right. No, I didn't know that. The I did... I can't remember the name of the show.
I have to find my old interviews anyway. They're in the basement of this location on magnetic tape.
Wow.
Reel to reel at that. And
that's how I learned. I started with.
And unlabeled.
The unlabeled is a problem.
It's a major problem, and we're reaching the outer limits of the life of Oxide.
Yes.
So I have to find these interviews with people like Alfie Bester, who used to be on the show rather frequently, actually, because he'd just, well, have a few and come across town. So...
This is a project for interns and volunteers, which you might find among your listening audience.
Absolutely. And if you are, in fact, interested in cataloging radio, and I know there is myself and there is a person who created this radio show now at NPR who also needs all of the early episodes of Hour of the Wolf transferred from reel to reel to MP3. And, you know, this isn't to make money. We will make these freely available under Creative Commons.
Yeah, there's got to be some fantastic resources in there. I mean,
there really are.
Yeah, especially just the people you've been talking about having on.
Yeah, and for that matter, just when Adler was there by herself, I thought that was one of the great high points of radio. You people listen to All Things Considered. She's fine. She's great. But you don't know how good she was. Nice. Yes, you do. But anyway.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. That's awesome.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. The,
But this place is so messy, I can't show you what it looks like. It's horrible.
I have a word picture in my head.
Oh, yes. Books and tapes.
Yes. How can you go wrong with that, really?
I have no interest in digitizing the books.
No. Although, I have to say, you know, I got an e-book reader, and I am...
Oh, I'm not against them.
Well, what surprised me was I had been on the road for about a month, and I was just using the ebook reader, and got back to Portland, and picked up a paperback, and thought, and this surprised the heck out of me, this is an unpleasant reading experience. And the reason was because I had to hold the book open all the time, and I'd gotten used to the ebook reader, which I could just lay down on the table and only touch when I needed to turn the page, without finding it's like, well, let me prop this open with this tube of toothpaste, and you know, or heaven forbid, crack the spine. But the other aspect was that even then, holding it, I would have to rock it slightly back and forth to read the words as they turned into the corner, into the center of the page, which. You know, it's something I've done my entire life and have never thought about, and it's never bothered me before. Never even something I've been conscious of.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've discovered is hardbacks. I still prefer hardbacks.
Yes.
You know, mass market paperback. If my only choice is that or an ebook, I'm gonna get the ebook.
Okay. Now, are we talking digital ink or something with
digital
backlighting?
Ink.
Okay.
Yeah. Although I do actually read on the computer too, but
because there are people who think that the iPad is but an ebook reader. What it is, it's a tablet, a computer that has an ebook reader application, and will doubtless have more, just as computers do. So we're talking about a dedicated, what they call digital ink.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although
difficult to describe on the radio.
Yes.
But they're astonishing.
It really the contrast. The page itself looks like it's recycled paper because it's not a brilliant white.
Mm-hmm.
But man, it looks like text.
The first time I saw one, went into a technology store, and I said, oh, there's, I guess it was the Kindle, whatever one mm-hmm. of the first ones was. And I thought, too bad they don't have it working, because they just have a sheet of paper pasted on it. And I was with my partner, who's a technology journalist and science fiction writer and all that good stuff. And we are looking at this together, and she picked it up, and the page changed. And our jaws hit the floor. That was our introduction
That's
to
fantastic.
E-book readers.
Yeah.
To the digital ink concept.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, for line drawings, it's really good. For grayscale, eh. But for line drawings, it's really good, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially when you see those and they've got the drawn pictures of Dickens or James Joyce or something, that's fabulous.
Yeah.
And that's actually as far as I want them to take it. I don't care about color.
Well, I mean, I would like color because I think that it would be really nice to use them for graphic novels.
Yeah, I guess so. If one could switch back and forth, but could you do the digital ink then and have it the same?
Well, they are working on that. I know that there's
some... Oh, I've seen some of the applications. I won't judge them because it's too early.
Yeah, I'm sure that it will come. Where, you know, because when I first had my, you know, my first Palm Pilot and it was black and white, I'm like, why would I ever want color? And, you know, when you get color, it's like, oh.
No, actually, I had the Palm 3.
Yeah.
No, 5. Yeah. I had the 5. I was a latecomer.
Yeah, oh, that's why I want color, because it's actually useful for some things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I would be fine with it. And the other thing is, you know, with that is one of the places where the production costs, the scale would shift a little bit.
Yes.
With a regular book, the production cost for producing an e-book is not actually that much less than producing a printed book.
Yeah, I find that astonishing. But yeah. I've read that. Now, well, because, there was a wonderful article in The New Yorker about 2 months ago on that.
Because the cost per actual physical copy of a printed book, depending on the size of the run, can be like, you know, $1, $2.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're, you know, everything else is the cost of, you know, the author writing it, the marketing of the book, the cover art, the layout, the design, and every ebook reader has to have a different layout.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at books that have multiple colors on the interior, that's where the production cost starts to go up for a physical book, but not so much with a printed book, with an ebook.
Right. Yeah. It's going to be the hardware. It's going to be the technology.
Right. So, you know, and the designer, but if, you know, it's possible that if we have color ebooks, that this may, in fact, lead to some really gorgeous interior designs.
Well, the objections that I have will be answered within a few years.
Yeah.
They'll probably be selling them beforehand.
Yes.
But they will, with the fact that there is such a big market for this stuff now, means that there won't be one company dictating to all, and that there will be a technology war, and that's good for us.
Yes, yeah.
But let me tell people that whichever technology you are using, I think it's wonderful that people can look up free science fiction stories and free science fiction books and find any, I'd say what, you have about 3?
Oh.
You're one of the first writers I encountered on the different, was it through Goodreads? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, I'm on.
Or Feedbooks. It was one of the services that give free stories.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I have, when I was up for the Campbell Award, I did a Creative Commons license release of a couple of different stories, which are still up on the website. And very kindly, different people who are reading it translated it into whatever format they wanted, and so I have multiple formats of those. But anytime I have a story that is online, I'm very happy for people to read it. It's like, you know, I'll just put up a version, put up a link so you can grab it. But
also the fact that it's available through all the different readers, because I found one on my phone in hours within acquiring mm-hmm. the smartphone.
Yeah. Well, the reason I'm flying home tonight and cannot be with you live in the studio tomorrow is because I'm up for a Locus Award tomorrow night for a novelette. I see
Finding
you're not,
wood tonight.
See
so
you're
yes.
knocking on wood there. I'm up for a story for a novelette that was on Tor.com called First Flight, and Tor.com. Although you know it's an electronic magazine, but what was great was that they decided to go ahead and release them on several different formats. So they turned it into a Kindle book. You can get it for the Nook. You can get it for the iPad and the iPhone, and you know all of these.
And I assume there's an EPUB format.
An EPUB
which is sort
for
of
the
vanilla.
Sony, yeah. For the Sony.
Well, no, EPUB is translatable
yeah.
into anything and can be read by. It's the closest thing to a lingua franca.
Yeah, it's the closest thing to the MP3 for the...
Yeah, exactly.
But what was, I mean...
I was just thinking how wrong the term lingua franca
yeah.
is today, but...
Well, you know, there is that. But the thing that was great, great, and by great I mean staggers and baffles me,
mm-hmm.
The editor, Patrick Nielsen Hayden, sent me this screenshot of the Amazon store, and First Flight was number 4.
Wow.
Number 4 of free downloads, and this is not science fiction. This
just
is
of free downloads.
Yes, and it's stayed in the top 10 for like...
So along with what, probably Arthur Conan Doyle and...
Well, it was... they had
Dickens, I would guess.
They had... Actually, no, the top 4 were all science fiction.
My.
Yeah, well, partly because that week, I should say, because of course, partly because Tor had released 4 different stories that were up. They have 4 stories that are up for major awards.
Yeah, but this is a huge market. This isn't just the
SF.
And part of my guess is that it is still to a large extent techno fans who are using these devices,
yeah.
and therefore they are more apt to read science fiction than just your average bookstore shopper.
At the Nebula Awards in L.A. last year, which is the award ceremony that the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America hosts, there's always a business meeting, and we talk about state of the industry, and we had some representatives talking about the Kindle, and they said that proportionally science fiction readers account for a huge percentage of ebook sales.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I
mean,
the first thing you look at what's being distributed on technology, and for that matter, the first stuff that gets pirated
yeah.
is the science fiction mm-hmm. stuff.
Yeah, and it's...
And that's a whole other conversation.
It is a whole other conversation.
Which I would love to have. Maybe that we can do over the phone on the air.
Maybe so.
I would love to do a whole show on copyright, Creative Commons, piracy, all that. And now you're the vice president of the aforementioned Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America.
Well, as of July 1.
Ah, well, you were elected.
Yes, I was elected.
You have been elected.
Yes, I'm the secretary, but on July 1, I've become...
Okay, so you're going from
one board position to another.
To
yeah.
a greater one. You and John Scalzi
mm-hmm.
will be responsible for the organization.
Yes, and I think that the correct technical term for that is...
Yes, and with such a backbiting campaign, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, evil, yeah. evil. I mean, you yeah. know...
What was it? There were a number of horrible announcements I saw on April 1st.
Yes.
All about that.
That's right. For those of you in our listening
audience,
we
need to explain this, yes.
I was running unopposed, and on April 1st I posted, and just in case this comes as a surprise, you can't actually believe anything I post on my website on April Fool's Day, and yet... I posted that I had been thinking about it and that I felt like I needed to withdraw from the race, and went on to list increasingly ridiculous reasons, and said that fortunately Alan Smitty had agreed to take over, and then linked to his...
I love his movies.
His movies are... Yeah, and he's done everything. He's
Dune.
Yes. Yes. So, you know, clearly there's a strong history in science fiction. And again, for those who, you know what?
I mean, there's a
Wikipedia.
Movie. You go to Wikipedia. There's also, I believe, isn't there like a movie biography of Alan Smithy?
Oh, is there?
That's or at least just one with his name in the title.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he's a character.
Yeah.
So, and actually, come to think of it, Dune wasn't directed by Alan Smithy because the Directors Guild didn't allow the name to be used for that particular film.
That's right, because people knew about it knew about it.
Yeah. It was too far. So, as I recall, he's the original director, Mr. Lynch, had the right to put a different name on it. And so I think it was like Judas Priest, directed by Judas Priest.
Nice.
Speaking of your website, before mm-hmm. we get to your reading, because we were talking so much about audio and mm-hmm. performance and all that, your website is probably the online destination for any writer who wants to know how to read.
I have a series on my website on how to read aloud, which I wrote. So I have 13 kind of thing posts or how-tos. And I did that because there are authors who have perfectly good instincts and are engaging, interesting storytellers and then just don't know how to read their own work.
And it's a funny thing because for many years I've gone around to science fiction mm-hmm. conventions and all that, doing little workshops. And then one year at, I think it was
ReaderCon
or something, I said, no, there's no need. Mary is doing it. And then the next year it was Kat Valenti is doing it. And it's like, whimper, because I'm not a writer. I don't have other things I can do. So
I'm not doing it this year, so it's all you. There's someone else, though, isn't there?
I don't know. There is someone else. There is a panel, and it's not the same thing. It's not teaching or maybe it is more about the technique of voice. And I'm not teaching that as much.
Yeah.
I'm teaching how to choose what to read, how to deal with your audience. In fact, I think what I am now teaching is in response to you so as not to do the same thing so that people can go to both and keep getting more and more out of it. And P.S., with these things, hear the other ways.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually really enjoy going to workshops on subjects that I teach because, you know, I pick up tricks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the what to choose to read is actually the number one that's the first mistake people make.
Mm-hmm.
They just pick the wrong thing.
Yeah.
It's not suited to their voice. It's not suited to be read aloud. I mean, you know, do not pick something with 8 characters.
Yeah, exactly. Do not do that. And more so, do not leave people hang. That's the other thing, is when you choose what to read, determine where is your... let it be self-contained, have some kind of a denouement.
Yeah,
there was
and
one of my...
You can do a cliffhanger if you're doing a cliffhanger, but it really has to be, and then he leapt and was hanging by the edge of the cliff! If you'd like to read the rest of the story...
Yeah.
I mean, that's different than, and then he went to the store...
Right.
And why would I be?
And then I looked at the watch and said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I'm out of time."
Yeah.
And that's a whole other thing. And this is maybe a third show. It's like Alton Brown on Good Eats.
Yeah.
Who he always says, "And what you can do with penis? Well, that's another show." And we're doing that here.
Much in that.
So what we need to do now is to take a brief break so that we can re-lubricate.
Yes.
And then you are going to read for us.
Yes, I am.
Excellent. So we'll be right back.
Okay.
Says I'm not pretty, and you know I'm seldom good, seldom good. Well, if no one ever marries me, I shine my square in a cage and a little rabbit hatch. No one marries me. No one marries me. No one marries me. If no one marries me, well, if no one marries me, I'll have a cottage near a wood and a pony all my own. Little lamb quite clean and tame that I can take to town. When I'm really getting old at 28 or 9, buy myself a little orphan girl and bring her up as mine. No one marries me. 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 Marries me. Well, if no one marries me. Marries me. Well, if no one marries me.
Natalie Merchant, from her album Leave Your Supper. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming at WBAI.org, where programs are also archived for about 2 weeks. This program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me this morning on recording from just yesterday afternoon, Friday afternoon, Mary Robinette Cowell. Cowell, rather. You see, I have to be careful about that. It's Cowell. Anyway, it's a subtle difference. At any rate, after talking so much about performances and ebooks and voice acting and all that, we're going to hear a wonderful reading. So I'm in a different place now. If anybody listening in stereo can actually tell, and I mean that in an audio sense.
Yes.
In a different place. But we're back,
mm-hmm.
and Mary, you're going to read for us.
That is correct. So this is an excerpt of chapter one from Shades of Milk and Honey.
Being published by Tor Books.
And out in audio from Macmillan Audio. It's a simultaneous release on August 3rd. Hardback, electronic, and audio. Whee! So, Shades of Milk and Honey. The Ellsworths of Long Park Mead had the regard of their neighbors in every respect. The Honorable Charles Ellsworth, though a second son, through the generosity of his father, had been entrusted with an estate in the neighborhood of Dorchester. It was well appointed, and used only enough glamour to enhance its natural grace, without overlaying so much illusion as to be tasteless. His only regret, for the estate was a fine one, was that it was entailed, and as he had only two daughters, his elder brother's son stood next in line to inherit it. Knowing that, he took pains to set aside some of his income each annum for the provision of his daughters. The sum was not so large as he wished it might be, but he hoped it would prove enough to attract appropriate husbands for his daughters. Of his younger daughter, Melody, he had no concerns, for she had a face made for fortune. His older daughter, Jane, made up for her deficit of beauty with rare taste and talent in the womanly arts. Her skill with glamour, music, and painting was surpassed by none in their neighborhood, and together lent their home the appearance of wealth far beyond their means. But he knew well how fickle young men's hearts were. His own wife, while young, had seemed all that was desirable. But, as her beauty faded, she had become a fretting invalid. He still cherished her from habit, but often he wished that she had somewhat more sense. And so Jane was his chief concern, and he was determined to see her settled before his passing. Surely some young man would see past her sallow complexion and flat hair of unappealing mousy brown. Her nose was overlong, though he fancied that in certain lights it served as an outward sign for strength of character.
Mr. Ellsworth fingered his own nose, wishing that he had something more to bequeath to Jane than such an appendage. He slashed at the grass with his walking stick, and turned to his elder daughter as they walked through the maze comprising the heart of the shrubbery on the south side of the house.
"Had you heard that Lady Fitzcameron's nephew is to be stationed in our town?"
"No." Jane adjusted the shawl about her shoulders. "They must be pleased to see him."
"Indeed! I believe that Lady Fitzcameron will extend her stay rather than returning to London as she had planned."
He tugged at his waistcoat and attempted to speak idly.
"Young Livingston has been made a captain, I understand."
"So young. He must have acquitted himself ably in His Majesty's Navy, then." Jane knelt by a rosebush and sniffed the glory of the soft pink petals. The sunlight reflected off of the plant, bringing a brief bloom to her cheeks.
"I thought perhaps to invite the family for a strawberry picking Thursday next."
Jane threw her head back and laughed. It was a lovely laugh, at odds with her severe countenance. "Oh, Papa! Are you matchmaking again? I thought Lady Fitzcameron had it set in her mind that the captain was to marry Miss Fitzcameron." He stabbed the ground with his walking stick.
"No, I am merely trying to be a good neighbor. If you have so little regard for the Fitzcamerons as to shun their relations, then I have misjudged your character."
Jane's eyes twinkled, and she pecked him on the cheek. "I think a strawberry-picking party sounds delightful. I am certain that the Fitzcamerons will thank you for your courtesy to them." The tall yew hedges hugged the path on either side of them, shielding them from view of the house. Overhead, the sky arched in a gentle shell of blue. Mr. Ellsworth walked in companionable silence beside his daughter, plotting ways to bring her together with Captain Livingston. They turned the last corner of the maze and went up the long walk to the house. On the steps he paused.
"You know I only want the best for you, my dear."
Jane looked down. "Of course, Papa."
"Good."
He squeezed her arm.
"I shall check on the strawberries, then, to make certain they will be suitably ripe for next week."
He left her on the steps and went to the hill on the east side of the house, making plans for the party as he walked. Jane folded her shawl over her arm, still thinking of her father's thinly veiled plans. He meant well, but would surely tip his hand to Captain Livingston, who was, after all, several years her junior. She had first met Henry Livingston before the war broke out, when he wintered with Lady Fitzcameron while his parents were away on the continent. He had been an attractive boy, with large dark eyes and a thick crop of unruly black hair. Though a favorite of Lady Fitzcameron, he had not been back to the estate since, and it was hard to imagine him as a grown man. She shook her head, settled the folds of her muslin frock, and entered the drawing-room. The smell of jasmine nearly overpowered her, burning her nose and making her eyes water. Her younger sister, Melody, who wove the folds of glamour in the corner, was evidently the source of the overwhelming aroma. "Melody, what in heaven's name are you doing?" Melody jumped and dropped the folds of glamour in her hands. They dissolved back into the ether from whence she had pulled them.
"Oh, Jane, when I visited Lady Fitzcameron with Mama, she conjured the loveliest tint of jasmine in the air. It was so elegant, and I cannot understand how she managed such a subtle touch."
Jane shook her head and went to open the window so the jasmine fragrance could dissipate with more speed.
"My dear, Lady Fitzcameron had the best tutors as a girl, including, I believe, the renowned German glamourist Herr Scholz. It is hardly surprising that she can manage such delicate folds."
When Jane let her vision shift to the ether, so that the physical room faded from her view, the lingering remnants of glamour were far too bulky for the effect that Melody had been trying to attain. Jane took the folds between her fingers and thinned them to a gossamer weight which she could barely feel. When she stretched them out, they spanned the corner in a fine web. Once she anchored the folds to the corner, the glamour settled into the room, vanishing from view. The gentle scent of honeysuckle filled the room, as if from a sprig of flowers. It took so little effort that she barely felt light-headed. Melody squinted at the corner where Jane had left the web, as if trying to see the invisible folds. "Please do not squint, dear. It is unbecoming." She ignored Melody's scowl and turned back to the web.
not for the first time, she wondered if Melody were nearsighted. She could never handle fine work, even with needlepoint, and her glamour seemed limited to only the broadest strokes. "What does it matter?" Melody threw herself on the sofa. "I have no hope of catching a husband. I am so abysmally poor at all of the arts." Jane could not help herself. She laughed at her sister. "You have nothing to fear. Had I half your beauty, I would have more beaux than the largest dowry could settle upon me." She turned to straighten one of her watercolors on the north wall. "Mr. Dunkirk sends his regards." Jane was thankful that her back was to her sister, for the sudden flush she felt would have given her away. She tried to hide the growing attachment she felt towards Mr. Dunkirk, particularly since he seemed to have a higher regard for Melody, but his gentle manner drew her to him. "I hope he is well." She was pleased with the steadiness in her voice. "He asked if he could call this afternoon." Melody sighed. "That is why I wanted to freshen the drawing room." The wistfulness in Melody's voice would only be appropriate if she had reached an understanding with him. Jane turned to her sister, scrutinizing her countenance. A gentle glow suffused Melody's delicate features. She stared into the middle distance, as if her cornflower blue eyes were blinded by a radiant image. Jane had seen the same expression on her own plainer face in unguarded moments. She could only hope that Melody had been more cautious in company. She smiled gently at her sister. "Shall I help you set the drawing room to rights, then?" "Would you?" "Of course." The drawing room already had a simple theme of palm trees and egrets, designed to complement its Egyptian revival furniture. For the better part of an hour, Jane and Melody twisted and pulled folds of glamour out of the ether. Some of the older folds of glamour in the palm trees had become frayed, making the images lose their resolution. In other places, Jane added more depth to the illusion by creating a breeze to ruffle the fronds of the glamour. Though her breath came quickly and she felt light-headed with the effort of placing so many folds, the effect was well worth such a trifling strain. Placed in pairs in the corners of the room, the trees seemed to brush the coffered ceiling, accenting its height with their graceful forms. Between each tree, an egret posed in a pool of glamour, waiting an eternity for the copper fish hinted at below its reflection. Simpler folds brought the warm glow of an Egyptian sunset to the room, and the subtle scent of honeysuckle kissed the breeze. When all was settled, Jane seated herself at the pianoforte and pulled a fold of glamour close about her. She played a simple rondo, catching the notes in the loose fold. When she reached the point where the song repeated, she stopped playing and tied the glamour off. Captured by the glamour, the music continued to play, wrapping around to the beginning of the song, with only a tiny pause at the end of the fold. With care, she clipped the small silence at the end of the music and tied it more firmly to the beginning, so the piece repeated seamlessly. Then she stretched the fold of glamour to gossamer thinness until the rondo sounded as if it played in the far distance. The door to the drawing room opened. Melody leapt to her feet with a naked expression of welcome on her face. Jane rose slowly, trying to attain a more seemly display. She placed her hand on the pianoforte as the room spun about her with the lingering effects of working glamour, but only their father entered the room.
"Hello, my dears!"
The plum brocade of his waistcoat strained across his ample middle. He looked around the drawing room in evident pleasure.
"Are we expecting company?"
Melody said. "Mr. Dunkirk said he would honor us with a visit this afternoon."
"Did he?"
Her father looked befuddled.
"But I saw him not 15 minutes ago, passing through our fields with the Fitzcamerons. They looked for all the world as if they were going hunting. Are you certain you did not mistake his meaning?"
Melody's face soured. "His meaning was clear, but perhaps he preferred to spend the afternoon in the company of a lady than a farmer's daughter." Jane winced as Melody flew from the room.
"Good heavens! What has gotten into the child?"
Mr. Ellsworth turned to Jane with his eyebrows high.
"Does she think that the whole neighborhood must dance attendance to her whims?"
"She is young, and..." Jane hesitated to commit her sister's potential indiscretion to words. But as her sister had not taken her into confidence, and as Jane feared for Melody's state of mind, she continued on. I fear she may be developing an attachment to Mr. Dunkirk.
Does he return it?
I do not know. Jane plucked at the waist of her frock. Certainly his behavior has been above reproach in every instance which I am aware. Mr. Ellsworth nodded, evidently satisfied with that reassurance.
Then we must hope that Melody will not embarrass herself while we wait for this fancy to pass.
The front door slammed. Jane hurried to the window and peered out. Melody strode across their lawn, heading for the fields between their home and Banbury Manor. Jane caught her breath. I fear that is what she has set out to do. Her father looked over Jane's shoulder.
I will go fetch her before she can damage our neighbor's good opinion of her.
Jane nodded, though she wanted to tell her father to let Melody do as she would. Let the headstrong girl make a fool of herself. The rational part of Jane knew that Melody was not her obstacle to Mr. Dunkirk's affection. Jane was too plain and too quiet to engender an interest in him or any other gentleman. Jane turned from the window and sat at the pianoforte. She loosened the fold about it, silencing the distant music. Quietly she began to play, losing herself in the music. Her fingers played across the keys and stroked thin folds of glamour on the ebony and ivory surfaces. Colors swirled around her in answer to the sound. She welcomed the light-headedness, which came with too much glamour, as a distraction from her cares. When the front door opened, Jane kept her attention on the pianoforte. She did not want to speak with Melody and have to comfort her. But that was unjust. Melody could not know how her actions affected Jane. Bringing the song to a close, she looked up as the colors around her faded. Mr. Dunkirk stood in the door to the drawing-room. His face was alight with wonder.
"Forgive me, Miss Ellsworth. I had told your sister I would call, and am later than I intended."
Jane's heart pounded with more than the effort of glamour, and a flush of warmth flooded her face. "Mr. Dunkirk, you have just missed her. She has gone for a walk with my father." Jane rose with care, pretending that gray blobs did not swarm in her sight. She would not swoon in front of him. "But please be welcome. May I offer you tea or a brandy?"
"Thank you."
He accepted the brandy she offered, and raised the glass to her.
"I had no idea you were such an accomplished musician and glamorist."
Jane looked away. "It is an idle amusement, sir."
"Nonsense. Music and the other womanly arts are what bring comfort to a home."
He looked at the palm trees and egrets adorning the drawing-room.
"I hope to have a home such as this one day."
Jane put her hand on the piano to steady herself, keenly aware that she was alone with him. "Indeed," she murmured, "though I would venture to say that Robinsford Abbey is most gracious."
"But it lacks that comfort which a wife with the gift of glamour might bring."
He inhaled the scent of honeysuckle and exhaled it in a sigh.
"Other men might seek a lovely face, but I should think that they would consider exquisite taste the higher treasure. Beauty will fade, but not a gift such as this."
"Do you not think that glamour might be learned, whereas beauty is innate?"
"Glamour, yes, but not taste, I think."
He smiled and inclined his head.
"It was a conversation close to this topic which prompted my tardy arrival here. Have you had occasion to meet Mr. Vincent?"
"I'm afraid you have the better of me."
"Ah, I thought Miss Melody might have mentioned him. Lady Fitzcameron has retained his services to create a glamural for her dining-hall. He is a fascinating fellow, who studied with Herr Scholes and has taken commissions from the Prince Regent. Stunning talent, really."
"Did Melody meet him, then? It seemed odd that her sister would fail to mention it. Visitors to their neighborhood were rare enough to be newsworthy, but to have such an accomplished glamorist in the vicinity was a significant event."
"I thought they had, but perhaps I am mistaken. In any case, Mr. Vincent had much to say on the subject of glamour, which I think you might find to be a compelling argument in my favor.
The front door opened again, and Melody flung the door to the drawing-room wide. Her face was red and stained with tears. When she saw Mr. Dunkirk, she uttered a cry of dismay and fled the room. Jane closed her eyes. Poor Melody! What must she think? To see Jane quite alone with a man for whom Melody so clearly had an attachment must seem as a betrayal. When Jane opened her eyes, he had set his glass down to greet Mr. Ellsworth. Excusing herself, Jane said, "I feel that I must check on Melody."
"I hope she has not suffered an accident,"
Mr. Dunkirk said. Jane's father harumphed and mumbled that Melody had twisted her ankle while walking, to which Mr. Dunkirk replied,
"Then I will leave you to tend to her."
He took his leave, only pausing at the door to say, "May I call again?"
"Of course," Mr. Ellsworth beamed. "Come whenever you like."
"Then I will see you soon."
Mr. Dunkirk bowed.
"Your daughter is a credit to you, sir."
When the front door closed, Mr. Ellsworth said,
"Well, Melody needn't have worried after all. A credit!"
Jane smiled. "Indeed."
And that's the end of that excerpt. Chapter 1 continues on from there, but...
In sailing all my source and wide, your heart will lead to me all the way guide. With some sea and faith and wide, yourself in port you sure to find.
My heart says to this maiden strike, she's captured you, she's just the sort of girl you like. You know you do, if other men a horse should gain, I shall resign, that's what it says to me quite plain. This heart of mine, this heart of mine.
My heart says you've a prosperous lot, with acres wide you mean to settle all you've got. Upon your bride, it don't pretend to shape my acts, my word or sign, it merely states these simple facts. This heart of mine, this heart of mine.
10 minutes since my heart said white, it now says black, it then said left, it now says right. Hearts often tag, I must obey its latest strain. You tell me so, but should it change its mind again, I let you know, I let you know.
You say that all my soul should wind, and all the heart should be your guide. But it is awkward when you find the heart of heart that does not know its mind. The heart does not know its mind.
End of that excerpt. Chapter 1 continues on from there, but...
And again, the name of the book?
Shades of Milk and Honey by Mary Robinette Kowal. That's me.
And now, I know that we're shy on time.
Mm.
So what we need to do is we need to drive people to the website.
My website is maryrobinettekowal.com.
And let's spell the whole thing.
Yeah,
out.
I think so. M-A-R-Y... Robinettekowal.com.
There we go. And, of course, one can just search up using your preferred search engine, which is probably Google. Or good. Bing's getting better.
Yeah, you could search
Bing's
anything.
Good. Yeah,
yeah,
you know, one way or the other.
Yeah.
And look up Mary Robinette Kowal.
Mm-hmm.
Either way.
And actually, shadesofmilkandhoney.com points to the same website.
Ah, okay. I haven't looked there yet. So is that a Tor-built site, or is that one of your own?
No, that's actually, what that does is that takes you to a page for Shades of Milk and Honey on my website.
Ah, okay. So it's a redirect.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
And that's awfully exciting.
I'm really excited.
And I wish we had more time, because I would want to ask... the difference between the long form and the short term form, the composition and all that.
Yeah.
This is I drive a mutual friend of ours crazy, Ms. Batlow, who had hired me as an interviewer for various of her online ventures. And I worked for Omni and I worked for Event Horizon. And every time, I would ask the same question that I often ask on the air, which is, which form do you prefer? And she was, Jim, you're always asking the same question every time. And yes, there's a reason for that.
Well, my feeling is, why do I have to choose?
Well, yeah. Well, now, especially in today's world of ebook reading and all that, we're not faced with the same limitations. But
yeah.
But you see, one of the answers, because you gave the artist's answer, some people will give the financial answer.
Answer,
I purposely never couch the question.
Although, you know...
By the way, if you're going to be interviewed on the show, don't listen. So, spoilers.
Yes.
But no, that's because some people will say, well, you're going to spend 2 months writing a short story, and then you're going to receive, if you're lucky, $70 after, you know, exposing the publisher on a forum.
No, you just need to pay attention to
that. Yeah.
You just need to pay attention to who you're submitting to.
Yeah, well, there is that. And in terms of your other job, for more good information on that, people can make use of the lovely redesigned website of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, which is actually spelt with one F. It's sfwa.org.
Yes, the way to think about it is that the S stands for science fiction, and the F stands for fantasy.
So actually, it could be still scientific. that would, because that's one word.
Yeah. I mean, my feeling is, you know,
am I showing my geek
code
here?
Okay. You know, aside from the fact that that people's heads would explode if we ever did this, and I mean, it would be rebranding, and it doesn't actually make, there's no need to do rebranding.
It was tried.
I would love to see it change to Speculative Fiction Writers of America.
Yeah, how about that?
Because speculative fiction is a nice umbrella term that covers science fiction and fantasy and horror and alternate history and slipstream.
And for those people who think that's a new term that modern people came up with, the term was coined in 1946.
Really? I didn't know
by Robert Anson Heinlein.
I love Heinlein.
Heinlein is the person, it's unbelievable, Heinlein coined the term speculative fiction.
I did not know that.
For Campbell, in one of his essays for Campbell. Who knew? I found that out somewhere.
Yes.
But so, you know, for the people going, oh, isn't that touchy feeling, what'll be next year? No, this is a time-honored term that came only, I think science fiction only began, 1939 or something like that, and before that it was scientific fiction.
Yeah.
And Heinlein actually campaigned to change it in parlance to spec fic, to speculative fiction, because he wrote all of these things.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Is like, I don't write just one thing. Like, the story that is up for the Locus Award is, it's science fiction story. It's a time travel story.
And yet it is all of one genre.
Yeah.
Even though there's witches science... Yeah, yes, Lord of the Rings isn't Hal Clement.
Yeah.
Okay, but... But
certainly as a reader...
But they're of the same genre.
Yeah, and I am all over the map when I'm reading, because I like speculative fiction. I like the stories that ask, what if?
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly, and Asimov tried to coin what if fiction.
Yeah.
But we're getting off the fact that you have to go to Portland.
I do have to go catch a plane, yes.
And so we just need to do this more often. And even if we have to... I want you on the air live, but even if we have to record again, maybe in August...
Yes. Yes.
Let's, you know, work that out. Let's
Sounds
see
great.
What we can make that happen. So, I think that the main thing, there's doubtless other things to promote, but...
Shades of Milk and Honey is...
Shades of Milk and Honey is coming out in from Tor and Macmillan, if you want to read or hear it.
Yes.
Do both. And the... but also, MaryRobinetteCole.com is the portal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All things Mary Robinette Cole-esque.
Yes. You can look at my puppetry there, which we didn't even talk about.
Oh, God, yes.
It's okay.
Well, actually, we did some last time you were
on
the show.
Yeah,
but,
that's right.
But I don't know that we have exactly the same listeners
this time as
last time.
Here's a bit of trivia for listeners, since we're on the radio. This originally, Shades of Milk and Honey, started as a short story. And I got not very far into it and was like, you know what? This is longer form. And I was in the middle of starting a writing workshop at Willamette Radio Workshop. And so it had about 1,500 words, and I decided, you know, I think this is a radio play. So I actually...
My favorite.
I actually have the first, what is, you know, equivalent to the first chapter, the first installment of a serial of this, before I realized that I had, of course, chosen a visual form of magic for radio.
Well,
which,
as
you can
know,
do.
It can be done.
You can do that. But, and I think that I would actually have more success now. So one of my, when we were working with the contracts, I retained dramatic rights for this.
Ah, good for you.
And one of the things that I made very clear was that audio rights were different from dramatic audio rights. You have to, the contracts for these things are...
Yeah.
And I have a fantastic agent who let me mention Jennifer Jackson. I love you. I mean, actually, everyone I work with, my editor at Tor, Liz Gorinsky, is great. You know, my...
She's wonderful.
She's
all
wonderful.
There is to it, yeah.
You know, the people at Macmillan are wonderful, and everyone's just great. But so one of my goals is to actually do a radio series of Shades of Milk and Honey.
Well, I certainly, you know, if you don't find another route, I certainly know an outlet that would be more than happy to broadcast it.
Well,
if not on Hour of the Wolf, I would fight for its own time slot. But failing that, there's always Hour of the Wolf, which also brings it to the web.
There you go. And it would be slightly different because, you know, of course...
Different medium. You have to...
Tell the story in the medium that you're in.
Exactly. And this is a whole other discussion and
we
a whole other...
We could have so many conversations.
Yes, well, we can and we should. So thank you again
thank
so,
you so much.
I'm so
me
pleased
on.
This worked out.
Yes, thank you so much.
And this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. And you heard an interview with Mary Robinette Cowell that was conducted yesterday, but a mere yesterday, Friday, June 25th, in an undisclosed, well, we knew where it was, but to you, an undisclosed location in Brooklyn. And hopefully, we were going to try to work out taking listener calls through the phone, but Mary has to be up at something. Well, there's that Locus Awards thing today. So, you know, she's busy, as well she ought be. So, works for me, because this way I can say, and I did say to her in an email, good, now you've got to do another show, because I mean, we barely scratched the surface of all the things we could talk about, including, by the way, getting down to her writing, which is just so much fun. So again, the novel, coming out in August, is Shades of Milk and Honey, and you can see her perform from the book at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series that month, in August. The next reading series... Well, actually, I should tell you first that the next episode of Hour of the Wolf is going to be, again, thrilling, as was this week's. Our guest next week will be Paolo Bacigalupi, who is basically currently considered a phenom in the world of science fiction, fantasy, and for that matter, literature altogether. And he, his new novel, The Wind-Up Girl, just won the Nebula Award. Is this ready for me? The stool here? Thank you. Just won the Nebula Award for Best Novel about a month ago, and deservedly so. His collection of short stories, which is really what launched his career. And it's a hard thing, by the way, to have your first book be a collection of stories and go on from there. Publishers are, well, that didn't do well, did it? Because stories in general just don't sell as well.
And his new novel is two new novels in the space of relatively short time. Shipbreaker is a YA, that is to say, a young adult novel. And, you know, he's a kind of person whose, the reviews of whose work are transcending the media. He gets a lot of media, transcend the genre, and he's getting a lot of media attention and all that. So, he will be our guest next week, live, yes, indeed. And then, the Tuesday after that, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will be, in fact, the aforementioned Paolo Bacigalupi. And with him, Saladin Ahmed, which attentive listeners to this show will remember from, I guess it was a little under a year ago. No, actually, maybe a little over a year ago that Saladin was last here. And he is now, he wasn't then, but he is now a member of the Altered Fluid Writing Group. So they will be here en masse in August. Right after Paolo reads for us at the NYRSIF reading, we are all bound for ReaderCon. So July 10th, Simon Lokley will be overseeing Why the Wolf Hasn't Come, which is a,
a conflation?
A conflation, yes, a conflation. I was going to say conglomeration. A conflation of Hour of the Wolf and Why the Revolution Hasn't Come, which was, in fact, the 5 to 8:30 slot from 1980 to 83, is that about right? Or earlier?
That's about right.
Oh, okay, yeah. And then Simon's best friend became program director and just cut his show in half. Put me in here. Fair enough.
That's the
gist.
Yeah.
Yeah, what are you doing this morning on your show?
I'm going to do something a little bit more on Ulysses in preparation for Monday's Stand-Up Academy.
Right, of course, which I am still going to try to make. It's still uncertain whether I can, but I am desperately going to try to go to the Swift on Monday at 7 p.m. or 6:30, really.
Well, yeah.
Get a good seat.
Starts at 7:30, but...
Oh, so 7:30. Well, get some fries, you know. Get some fries. They're actually very good.
It's a great place, isn't it?
It's a wonderful place. I've been there before, of course, for Joel's wake. But as opposed to the wake, that pulpit is, it looks like a Dalek. It really does. And what can one say? It looks like a Dalek. Ooh, finale tonight. Doctor Who ends in England tonight. Will all the people they've killed off come back to life? I think so. They need to bring them back for this episode, right? I don't think they're going to be doing a post-mortem exactly. By the way, somebody called, and let's make it clear, Mary Robinette Cowell's website is the place to go, by the way, for those articles that she has written on reading aloud. And somebody asked about my articles, and I really don't have so much articles. I have a I have an outline, which I've been meaning to flesh out with notes and stuff like that. And if people want my take, which is a little bit different from Mary's, and certainly mine is nowhere near as well written, it's notes for a talk, send me an email. I'd be happy to share that. And my email address is Jim, J-I-M, at ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F. Coincidentally, like the name of this radio show, Hour of the Wolf. And I guess I can try to sneak in some calls for about 3 or 4 minutes, although I should mention, by the way, that the reading, well, it's July 6th, the reading. I'll give, if you want more information on the reading, or if you'd like to join my mailing list for that reading series, send me an email again to jim@ourwolf.com. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
What a voice.
Oh, yes.
That's
fabulous.
All I can say. What a voice. You understand where moi comes from. Oh, I think listening to her mano a mano would be a joy of perfect measure.
I prefer listening to her stereo a stereo than rather a mano a mano.
Oh, no. You know, come on, James. You know what I mean.
You know what I mean. It's a pun.
What? Yeah. Oh, okay. I'd love to talk to her about accents, her British accent. Now, she sets this in the south of England. I'd love to ask her what she would do if she had a book set in the north of England. Would she change accents? I mean...
Well, of course she would.
Yeah. I mean, you cannot. Russell Crowe, I'm sorry. You don't sound Nottingham. I'm sorry. You just... That just doesn't work.
No. He's an Aussie, Russell Crowe.
Well, yeah, but he's not
and
Nottingham.
Kevin Costner didn't quite do Nottingham.
Oh, please.
Nottinghamshire either.
Please.
Having said that, I like that awful movie.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'll tell you what I like. The music. They got it right. If you're going to do a 12th century thing, you got to do 12th century music. None of this 101 Melocrino strings.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, the music was great. So, Bacigalupi, that's his real name? Bacigalupi?
Why not?
I hope nobody makes fun of him and asks him the question that somebody might.
I'm a punster. I don't even know
Costello,
what it is.
Mr. Bacigalupi, the fruit, the peddler, whatever, but he sounds wonderful. Saladin Ahmed, listen. When I think of Saladin Ahmed, the hooves of the hubble of Abdul Jamila.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story.
It really is. Well, let's hope next week that it's fun. I hope you really have her live. I know she's busy, but boy, what she'd be great for next.
Well, she was on the show already. And
Mary Robin and Cole?
Yeah, this is her second time.
Oh, I missed the first time.
I guess so.
All right, so we'll be listening next week. Have a happy.
Take care. Bye-bye. And, yes, okay, I've got like 90 seconds left. Hi there, you've got about 30 seconds. Good morning. Nope, they already gave up before they could get started. Ah, well. Okay, again, if you would care to write me, please feel free to do so. Jim@ourwolf.com. Stay tuned for As I Please with Simon Locally. Tune in to this program next week. You can. My website is woefully out of date. I sort of froze it when they stopped carrying 6 months' worth of archives for the show. It was sort of like, oh, why should I update this anymore? I just curmudgeoned on my site. However, there are 80 pages, believe it or not. That's not an exaggeration within my site. And a lot of it is still relevant. So do feel free to visit ourwolf.com because you'll be amazed at what it looks like after it gets its redesign real soon now. And in the meantime, I'm on Twitter. I'm sort of on Facebook, which is to say I post there remotely every so often. I'm just so annoyed at them. I hate going there. And I'm on Buzz. Okay. Ooh, I didn't cue up the outro music. Oh, for silly sake. I'm sitting here blathering away. I needed to start it by now. And I haven't. Sorry. Hold on for a moment. And Simon, we're going to have to do the halfway house, as it were, for getting that through. So that gives me, another couple of seconds now to waste. I'm trying to think if I had any more announcements. No, I think that more or less covers it. So, I'll just start the music. We'll fade it when we get to 7 a.m. Thank you, Mary, in case you're listening to this now or rebroadcast again. And we will see you in August when you come in to read at KGB. And in the meantime, everybody, take care. Have a wonderful week. Try to enjoy the weather. We'll see where it goes. And good health. Good week. And happy summer, by the way.
You are tuned to WBAI FM 99.5 FM, New York City. And good morning, and hello, and welcome to As I Please for this, the 26th day of June in the year 10. Yes, just 6 more months until Christmas. Do you believe in Santa Claus? And this weekend is, of course, the weekend where all the things to which we have grown accustomed are slated to change. I speak, of course, of the MTA. And sometime tomorrow, of course, they decide to engineer these changes on Sunday, knowing that it will affect us very little, so that we'll all be surprised Monday morning. And there'll be new routes and new lines and the same old disappointments, of course. Now, I've been reading about this because I'm sort of interested in how this will improve the quality of life amongst us New Yorkers. And I'm not sure that it's actually going to improve the quality of life, but I've heard a great deal about the importance of the route colors. And this is the changing of the route of the M is now putting it onto the RNW line. W is gone, might as well forget that. And so M has changed from a terracotta brown to a rather pasty egg yolk yellow. However, I hasten to point out that all this seems a bit moot anyway, because the new subways, the new cars, all have a digital display. And as you're standing looking down the platform waiting for the train, I can tell you that it is very difficult to determine whether that is an N or a W or a R coming, because they all look alike. So, tomorrow the changes begin, and we bid a fond farewell to the V train. And I'm glad to see the W go, although I can tell you right now that service out in the wilds of Queens is not bound to improve anytime soon. It's just the way I see it, by gum. So, be prepared, be informed. Now, I also wanted to mention, before I get down to work this morning, a little chapter in the annals of crime. And the story had its dateline in Canada. I didn't bring it with me because it was so striking that I remembered almost all the details. Out in Canada, a truck was stolen from a parking lot. And, of course, the people who owned the truck were quite miffed about this, particularly because of the cargo. And the cargo was, apparently, a couple of tigers and a pair of giraffes. Well, that just goes to show you, you know. There you are, a hardened criminal, looking at a truck, and you say, this I'm going to take with me. Only to discover that the cargo is not something that, well, has an immediate resale value. I am pleased to report that the animals have been recovered and are back on their way to, apparently, a private zoo. Sounds sort of like something Pacifica would have up its sleeve, right? A private zoo. But, it is just a moment. Just imagine, if you can, if you have an imagination, just imagine the surprise when the criminals open the door of the back of the truck to discover a couple of tigers in a cage. Whoa! Yeah, that would be something. All right, so there were the annals of crime. I think that, you know, WBAI should really spend a little bit more attention on crime and criminals, because everyone is fascinated by criminality. Now, is that not true? Of course it is. And I will now offer my softly worded protests. Yes, I don't feel that it's necessary to shake my fist or try to be a rabble-rouser. I merely point out that over the last few months, I have become quite tired, quite tired of the habit on television of squeezing the final, the closing credits of a movie or a program into a little strip at the bottom of the screen so that the television station or network can in some way or other promote itself. Now, I know, sometimes those closing credits do go on. However, there are occasions when You want to check something when you want to read it. So here we are, since we are living in an age where everything needs to be legislated, can we not start a campaign to let final credits roll in all their glory? By golly. I mean, there are times when the opening credits are also affected, so that you don't know who's in the cast. Now, of course, it makes a difference, right? Because all you want is a good show. But sometimes you just have that desire to know a little bit more. Like, who's playing that? Who's playing that role? Okay, so there's something for you to do. Now, this is the sort of legislation that probably could be passed quickly, because it seems to offend no one except television management. So we'll start a campaign, right? Right. And, of course, on along the same lines, another protest against smoker discrimination. My goodness gracious me, is it not clear that smokers are a dying breed? Let them die in peace! And you are tuned to WBAI New York City, where hard-hitting editorials are just a way of life. And if you like hard-hitting editorials, you have tuned to the right place. Although, I'm done for it now. By gum, I have nothing more to say in the hard-hitting department. I have more important fish to fry. Oh, I better do this too before I get to work. And this is about the Pacifica local board elections. I'm going to just give you this address so you can go out and find out all you want. You know, they request that we spend 15 minutes talking about this. as though we have nothing but time. The Pacifica local board elections are due sometime in the summer, and the deadline for candidates is the 30th of June. And so we decided to postpone telling you anything about this until the very last minute. So if you'd like to find out more about this, you can go to leswbai@pacifica.org. I guess that's it. And actually, if you are thinking about the idea of running for the local board, well, go ahead. I would really like to see on the local board people who do a little bit of reading. I would like to see people on the local board who are convinced that radio is first and foremost an artistic medium. And I say this because, as is demonstrated day in and day out around the world, politics rejects art. You know, it's just too fancy and too highfalutin. But art embraces and includes politics. Consequently, for a stronger radio station, we should be a more artistic radio station. Well, we'll dream on. In any case, the Pacifica Foundation 2010 elections. Run as a candidate. Getting to find out all that at the address I gave you. Or you can call this number, I guess. 1-866-PEACE-01, I guess. You know, another great thing, you know, running for the local board on the platform, I will disband the local board. That wouldn't be a bad idea either. And you are tuned to WBAI, where we are more than bored. We are actually tearing our hair out in frustration. WBAI, New York.